Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Reggie Brothers, Undersecretary for Science and Technology at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Also joining us from IBM is Angela Carrington. So, Dr. Brothers, would you tell us more about your R&D efforts in such key areas as cybersecurity, responder of the future, and enabling decision makers?
Sure. So in our cybersecurity division, CSD, we really think of it in of investments in five key areas. The first is trustworthy cyber infrastructure. Second is cybersecurity research infrastructure. The third is network and system security investigations. Fourth is cyber physical systems, SCADA systems, those kinds of things. Then the fifth actually is a transition and outreach. So we have a transition to practice program, which actually seeks to commercialize our cyber programs. And we have, it's been very successful to date. So that's the way we think about our cyber strategy. An example of what we're doing right now is, for example, the DECIDE program, which is developed by Norwich University with funding from us. And essentially, it's an exercise tool. It's an exercise tool for the financial industry. It's actually been used in games to understand just how the financial community can respond in the case of some attacks. And we actually had a number of 500 participants from 80 financial institutions and government agencies involved in this exercise. So that's the kind of things that we're looking at doing. It's across, I mentioned cybersecurity research infrastructure. So what's the challenge here? The challenge is that you need some type of testbed to be able to exercise your potential solutions, to understand, are these good or they're not so good, right? We need some way of working with government agencies, with the communities, to understand how well does this actually scale to their actual networks. So these are all the kinds of things that we're working in cyber. I think you also mentioned decisions, right? So here's one of the challenges. I think I've learned this over some of the work I've done, is that it's one thing to give an operator, a decision maker, some tools. It's another thing to help them make a decision more effectively and more quickly. So I think one of the challenges we have is, for example, a lot of times you see something called a common operational picture, or a COP, right? Yeah. And in this, you've got a map, some kind of geospatial map. You have different icons on it showing the location of people and infrastructure and different things of interest. And so the decision makers will look at this and then figure out, what does this mean? What do I do about this? As opposed to actually giving he or she some tools that help them parse that, to dissect it, to help them understand what that actually means based on the kinds of things that are going on today. So when you start looking at some of the tools in data analytics and predictive analytics, these kinds of things, you can start coming up with tools that actually help the decision maker make these decisions much more quickly, right? So here's an example of a decision. Let's say you have some type of natural disaster and the consequence of many natural disasters, some level of flooding. When do you tell people they should leave or not leave? How can you push that decision further to the left in time so they have more time to make a decision? How do you do that? And those are the kinds of things that we're working with to enable the decision maker.
Can you tell us more about the National Conversation on Homeland Security Technology, and how does it enable end users to connect directly with technology developers, and kind of what are the goals of these discussions?
Right. So, again, this came out of the when we're developing the visionary goals and we were almost crowdsourcing our results, a question was asked to me, what do you do if someone comes up with a strange idea? And I didn't read all the results personally, but I read a lot of them. I sampled a lot of these. And what I found, quite frankly, all of them I read were thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we realized we could really reach out to the greater community and get some good ideas. So that's what we've done. So essentially, we have a website where you can go to and engage in this and register and then engage in this conversation. So our first responders, our components, are using this to engage directly in conversations with creative people. So why is this important? It's important because, as I mentioned earlier, we're now in an environment where the creative people are all over the place, not just in laboratories or someplace. This enables us to have a much broader reach to get to these people, to let them know what our problems are, and to hear from them what problems that they see that we may not see, for example. So that's why it's important.
So you touched on this, but what are you doing to engage the kind of the non-traditional companies and revamp existing programs to become more timely and dynamic? And how are you looking to re-engineer internal forecasting capabilities to better understand where to capitalize on industry investment trends?
Okay, so there's two different things. Let me start with the first one. So I think there's I talked in some detail before about other transaction authorities, right, about accelerators, these kinds of things. But the general strategic way that we're thinking about that is, one, communicating what our challenges are, mm-hmm, to these different non-traditional players as well as to the traditional players. I don't want to downplay the importance of traditional players. But part of our biggest challenge is communicating our problems. So we're trying to find the right fora in which to communicate those challenges. And so we're choosing different ones, which we're experimenting again. The second thing is, once we've communicated those challenges, is finding novel, useful, relevant, efficient ways of getting investment dollars to them. So that includes not just on the investment vehicles I mentioned before, like OTAs, mm-hmm, but also how do we make it easier, but no less rigorous, for us to actually solicit for the work, right? So right now, we all know that some of the process for going through the solicitations is difficult, particularly for non-traditionals that don't have systems set up for going through this proposal process. So right now, we're working with the Undersecretary of Management's team to try to make it easier, to come up with ways that are easier, but yet no less rigorous, because we are dealing with taxpayers' money. So we have to make sure we're dealing with that most effectively. So let me talk about forecasting. This is one area that I think is essential. Now, you can argue whether or not you can effectively forecast or predict or not, and I think that's a discussion to have. Nonetheless, particularly when you talk about, can you predict a black swan event, which by definition you couldn't. That said, what you can predict are trends, right? You can predict trends. And so we are working with our partners actually at IARPA to work with technologies that have been developed there as well as developed other places to start looking at what are some trends, whether it be in publications, whether it be, it's primarily publications, to figure out where things are actually going. So, you know, one of the challenges I think we have is groupthink. Mm. It's groupthink. So when you talk to most technologists, you get a list of what are the upcoming technologies, and you find that many of these technologies are the same. You'll say, well, you know, biology, particularly synthetic biology, right? Some of the CRISPR technology that there was, you know, recently a conference on, you know, the ethics of that. You start talking about, of course, data analytics, predictive analytics, cloud computing. You start talking about artificial intelligence, deep learning. Talk about robotics, autonomy. So these are the kind of areas that most people are talking about, and others that I think if you start compiling a list of, you know, futurist conversations, these are the kind of things you'll come up with. The question I have to ask myself is, what are we not looking at? Within this groupthink environment, what are the things that we don't know we don't know? And that's really what I'm trying to push on, because I think the things that we don't know are the things that are going to come and bite us. Maybe more hard than the things that we do know are up and coming. So I think, you know, we have a program that we're working on right now to, along with our other interagency partners, to think about this. We're actually engaged with these other communities in Silicon Valley, Austin, Boston, et cetera, to talk about these, to try to figure out what they think. Because again, you know, the more diverse areas of thought that we get in the room, the better. And that's what we're really trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Brothers, could you tell us more about the innovation centers and what are their critical function they perform that complement the S&T mission space and strategy, and how do they operate and foster sort of an innovative or entrepreneurial culture?
So the innovation centers are like some of the other things I mentioned, experiments. We're just starting this. Mm-hmm. This was taken from my knowledge of what goes on in some corporations, and the fact that we are now setting up one with the Coast Guard, where we have some of our people with the Coast Guard at their research and development center. And what's the problem we're trying to solve? We're trying to solve this issue of how do we more quickly and effectively transition technology? How do we get it to our operational users in a form factor, in a package, et cetera, that really works with the way they do operations? Well, who knows that better than the operators themselves? So the best way to do that, I would argue, then, is to have ties directly into the operational components. That's what the innovation centers are actually all about. It gives the operational folks a better sense of what we know, So they get a sense of the art of the possible, and we get a better sense of the operational realities at the edge. So we have been working on this for, I think, about 8 months now or so. We've developed a set of initiatives, and I'm very excited about seeing the results of this.
And throughout our conversation, the idea of engaging stakeholders, in particular industry, to partner with them is very important. One of the programs I noted when I was doing the research for the interview is Titan. Could you tell us a little bit about Titan?
I can. So Titan is an effort to provide essentially a toolkit for our program managers. The reason why this toolkit is important goes back to this issue of we now have a much more diversified and distributed S&T ecosystem than we've ever had before, I'd argue. So this toolkit enables our program managers to reach out to our startup world. So we have ties. We work with InQtel. We have a Silicon Valley presence. It allows us to tie into our national laboratories. It allows us to tie into our centers of excellence, our academic institutions. So what I found was that we have these resources, but they're not necessarily tied together and aligned in terms of what they're doing. I think particularly now it's essential that these are aligned. So that, again, we have these our visionary goals. We've developed a 5-year actionable strategy. And now we have to make sure that the tools that we have, the resources we have, our laboratories, our universities, our industries, small, large, traditional, non-traditional, et cetera, are aligned in achieving these goals. So that's what Titan is all about. Titan is about allowing our engineers, our scientists, to have a place to go and say, well, here's the problem I'm trying to solve. What are some potential answers? If I go to the laboratory, what do I find? If I go to academia, what do I find, et cetera?
Great. And with that, the story that you've or the vision that you've outlined for the S&T Directorate, you have various things that are going on. And I wanted to, you know, get a sense of educating our listeners as to many of these programs. And one of them is APEX, the APEX program. Could you tell us a little bit more about how that balances your portfolio? And then how is it complemented by the technology engines?
So one of the challenges I think that we have, and I mentioned a couple times, is prioritization. Once you prioritize, though, you have to have a critical mass of investment dollars to actually make a difference. Again, we have about $450 million of annual investment. How do we do the best job we can of establishing critical masses in the most critical areas? That's what APEX is all about. So APEX says, given the visionary goals we have, given the input we're getting from our stakeholders, what programs should we have that we're going to invest enough money in to actually make a difference, to really make a difference? So, for example, we have, and you'll see the tie into our visionary goals. We have border situational awareness, next generation first responder, real-time biothreat awareness, next generation cyber infrastructure, checkpoint screening at speed, rapid, which is actually about flooding. I mentioned flooding example earlier. And there are air entry and exit reengineering, which is a border enforcement analytics program. So those are APEX programs. Now, you actually asked about the engines. If you think about our mission areas, you can start thinking about different areas that of technology that are cross-cutting across the capabilities that we could develop in those mission areas. That's what the engines are all about. So if you think about if you think visually, and on verticals you've got our APEX programs, then across those lay these engines. So these engines are areas that, to repeat, are these cross-cutting technologies that apply to all of our APEX programs. In fact, more broadly, they apply to all the mission sets of the QHSR. And that's really why the engines were set up. So I'll give you a couple of examples. We've got data analytics, right? Modeling and simulation. An interesting one, behavioral, economic, and social science, communication and networking. Right? So then there's others. But these are the ones that we have that we've set up in order to, again, more effectively use our investment dollars. Because while every program uses these, you don't want to have an independent instantiation of these within each program, when each program could borrow from these if they're used across all of them.
Well, you've pointed out that the visionary goals you identified are decades out. You have a strategic plan, which is about a 5-year time frame. All of these pretty much give insights into your strategy and how you're going to take S&T to where it needs to be. But none of this will happen, I think you underscore this, without your people. So what are you doing to create a strong or establish a strong and healthy leadership culture within S&T And how are you addressing some of the employee morale issues you're dealing with?
So again, work in progress. I think one of the principles you asked me about my particular take on leadership is empowering the workforce. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to be more transparent in why decisions are made, what decisions are made, and more inclusive in how those decisions are being made. So we're trying to do that. We've also developed an employee council where we actually asked employees to be part of this council and to give recommendations, suggestions, concerns, et cetera, so we can have a better pulse on actually what's going on in the organization. We've also funded a root cause analysis study to try to better understand what some of the challenges are in areas of morale. And based on that study, we are developing action teams to actually address those concerns that were brought up. I have a weekly address that I send out to try to communicate what I'm learning from the front office, from the secretary, deputy secretary, et cetera, and what some of my priorities are. We've set up multimodal, if you will, ways of for staff to communicate back with me and my front office some of their concerns. So I think a lot of what we're trying to do is transparency and enhanced communication within the organization.
What does the future hold for research and development within the Homeland Security enterprise? We will ask Dr. Reggie Brothers, Undersecretary for Science and Technology at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.